Joining me in the KFAR studios, Woody Johansson. Good morning.
Good morning, Gail.
There you go, a little bit close. You have a unique distinction. You were my last guest in 1984 and my first in 1985. We've got, I was telling our listeners earlier this morning that your story starts so far back, it was difficult to go from 1867 to 1984 in 55 minutes. So we're going to have you back. It was nice to have you back today. I'm glad you were able to do it.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Mr. H.W. Johansson. Interesting story. For those who didn't listen last week, they missed a fascinating birdcage name story. Maybe someone will catch him up on it. Well, last time we mentioned we do need to catch up on a couple of things for those that didn't listen last week, but that your grandfather, Adam Block, came to Alaska in 1867. Can you quickly recap that just in a minute?
Well, he was a sergeant in the Union Army at the time that Alaska was purchased from Russia, and his outfit was sent to Alaska for the transfer ceremony in Sitka, and of course, as a sergeant in that group, he participated in the transfer. From that time on, he stayed in the territory. He never left, and he ended up in Seldovia, owning a store and running a post office. And I personally never knew him. What I know of him is I have learned from relatives and from reading some of the books on Alaska history.
That leads to me to another thing I'd like you to explain. How did your interest in Alaska history, I don't know if a lot of people know this, I didn't until recently, but you are quite an historian and have a wonderful collection of books on Alaska and are well read in the field. How did it all start for you, aside from the fact that you were born here, but when did your intense interest start?
Well, Gail, the acquisition of books on Alaska is a very expensive proposition and an activity which my wife has sometimes regretted getting me started in. But about 1944 or 45, Dave Adler had a fire in his bookshop here on Cushman Street, and so he had a fire sale. And it was around my birthday time, so my wife went down and picked out a book, which happened to be Wickersham's Trails, Trials, and I can't recall the name, the complete name. But anyway, it's a very interesting book. It's still available. And he mentioned so many other parts of Alaska history in this book that I became curious, and so when he would mention one thing, I'd go find a book and read about it, and pretty soon I began acquiring the books, and I have been acquiring books on Alaska history since 1944.
Well, what I understand is fascinating about that, as you were reading along this history, you were finding mention of your own family in the written record.
That's right.
Now, in those days, it was kind of hard to, I guess, keep in touch and with
you didn't pick up a telephone and call people in the next town or the next state, but your only communication was by wireless. And there was not too much letter writing. We got, in Cordova, you got mail once a week. When the Alaska steamship boat came in, that was it.
Well, where we left off last week was that you had come to the university as a student, and this was in the 30s, I believe.
Yes, in 33.
And you had a job, as all students did, to work your way through the college. The college was supported by student workers, and you were a butcher, and had told us a story about the the cow and the yak cross. That was fascinating. What other jobs did you have while you were working at the to the university?
I was hired to help the cook in the kitchen and to do the butchering. And I recall we arrived on the train, of course, about the first week in September. And, of course, the next day I was at work. And I learned then that not only would I work in the kitchen, but and not only would I butcher the meat for the dining room, but also I was to provide the vegetables, which meant, I never will forget, on the 6th of September, I was out digging potatoes in about 4 inches of snow in the potato garden, which Dr. Bunnell had planted. It was located just south of the Allison Building, on that slope between the Allison Building and what is now the powerhouse. That whole slope was planted in potatoes. And so I dug potatoes, and I dug carrots and dug turnips, and then I took them to the dining hall and prepared them to be cooked. And it was a lot more, there was a lot more diversity than I had planned on.
Gee whiz.
And after I left the university in 35 and returned to Cordova, mainly because of lack of funds, and then I came back to the university in 37 after working for the summer for Dr. Patty and Bruce Thomas on Coal Creek on the Yukon. And I worked there until I graduated from the university.
Now, what did you do there?
One of the hardest jobs that anyone ever did. And there were an awful lot of us that did the same thing. We were point drivers.
Oh, my, I've heard about that.
And for 2 years, I worked on Coal Creek as a point driver. And then I was promoted to a point doctor on Woodchopper Creek.
Explain what a point driver is.
Well, in order to for the dredges to work the ground has to be thawed. And what a point driver does is drives a 3/4-inch pipe, a reinforced pipe, into the ground to bedrock. And then, of course, water flowing through, cold water, flowing through the pipe and down to bedrock and back up to the surface will thaw the ground. And points were placed about in a triangular pattern. I don't recall the exact distance, but I think it was about 12 feet apart. And it would then thaw the complete area. And depending upon the depth of the ground, why, it may take from 3 weeks to a couple of months to thaw it.
How big an area?
Well, the point fields varied in size depending on the amount of water available. But the areas that they usually thawed was at least the width of it that the dredge would work, which would be maybe 150, 200 feet wide, the face of the dredge. And then, of course, down the creek as far as they wanted to go.
You say it was really difficult work. What exactly, physically, did you do? What was involved in driving a point into the ground?
Well, the process consisted of a weight which was fitted around the pipe, and you might say an anvil which was clamped onto the pipe. And what your job was to lift this hammer and drop it on the anvil and turn. Of course, then you each time you hit while you turn the pipe. But there was so much a vibration in that hammer when it struck the anvil, and if you were foolish enough to have your hands on it, that it was common for the fellows from the university, and most of us at the university worked on them in the mines in summertime, and many of us drove points. And when you would get out of school, of course, you hadn't been doing any heavy work all year, and then you start in that point field, and at least for the first week, many times you wake up in the morning, you couldn't open your hands. They would be that stiff from pounding on those with that hammer. And but after about a week or two, you toughened up. And
how many hours a day did you work?
Well, when we were working for Patty, we worked every day of the week. And most mines did. And you'd work 10 hours a day.
What'd you make? Do you remember what you made?
Well, there's a story behind that, too. We made, we were 63 cents an hour. And that was the going wage in the Tanana Valley, including the same as the FE was paying, the Fairbanks Exploration Company. And they were more or less the setters of wages in the area. And I believe it was the second year in 38 we were there and on Coal Creek. And but before we left town, we knew that the FE company and the workers were negotiating for a raise in pay. And after we got out on Coal Creek, we learned that the raise was 10 cents an hour. And so the miners working for the Fairbanks Exploration Company were making 73 cents an hour. And of course, we working for Patty on Coal Creek felt that we should be getting 73 cents an hour too. So we approached Dean Patty and for the possibility of a raise, and I was one of three that approached him. And he was very nice about it, but he was also quite adamant that he just could not afford it. He had bought these dredges, and he had payments to make, and he had just bought a bunch of supplies in the spring to keep the operation going, and he just didn't have the money to do it. But he promised us that sometime in June, he should be in a position where he could raise our wages to 73 cents an hour. And, June came around and still no wages, no wage increase. And we talked to him about it, and he just kept postponing it. And the latter part of June, we had a cloudburst in the hills above the mining area on Coal Creek. And it was really a heavy cloudburst, and the water came down in torrents. And, of course, when it hit the mining area, it started washing out the hydraulic lines for the giants and also the lines in the point field, and it flooded the dredge pond. And, of course, Patty had wanted us to get out there and do something about it, salvage as much as we could. And we just told him we were sorry, we just couldn't go out until we got 73 cents an hour.
Oh.
And we got it. But the following year, there were some of us who had been active in that group, didn't have a job the next year. But anyway, we did get our 73 cents an hour.
That, oh my. This is Meet a Pioneer. We'll be back after hearing from some of our sponsors, Denali Chiropractic, Two Rivers Lodge, and Soapy Station.
Today's Alaskans are demanding more. More style, more options, more flexibility, and more for their money. And they're finally getting it from Sophie's Station, Fairbanks' newest, most attractive contemporary living complex. Sophie's Station is a prestigious addition to our community, designed for optimum quality, comfort, and convenience. For adult living at its best, see the new one- and two-bedroom units, now available at Sophie's Station.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality. The same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked-about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Alaska's pioneering spirit will never die. It lives on in second and third generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more about it. Just call 479-0485 or stop by and see Carol at 3525 College Road.
Thank you, Dr. Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic. And now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
I'm Gail Malloy, and this is Woodrow Johansson in the studio with me this morning. Woody, that on Cold Creek, now where was this actually, like on a map? Where would be, from here, where was it?
Well, it would be northeast of here. It's actually about 80 or 90 miles up the Yukon River from Circle City. And it's one of several creeks coming in on the left limit of the Yukon River. And
Yukon was your supply line.
Yes, at the time we were working there, most of the freight for the mines, in fact, all the mines on the Yukon down as far as Rampart, received their freight through Whitehorse, and the riverboats running from Whitehorse downriver to Tanana would deliver all supplies, including the diesel fuel and all the food and everything needed to survive. And when we left, the students who were working on Woodchopper and Coal Creek left to return to school, we were leaving before the operation was done. And so we had to provide our own transportation. And so what we would do is we'd rent a riverboat, and we would drift down the Yukon from Cold Creek or Woodchopper, wherever we happened to be, to Circle City. And a beautiful trip, take
Sounds
about a
nice.
Day.
Nice. Wow.
And once we get into Circle City, we would catch Johnny Palm's stage, which was really nothing but a truck, a flatbed truck, and Johnny did most of the freighting, hauling the freight that came to Fairbanks by way of Whitehorse. And there was quite a bit of it. And I recall one of the trips we came in with Johnny, he had his truck pretty well loaded, there were about five of us, and we just rode on top of whatever he had in his truck and came to Fairbanks. And when we got here to Fairbanks, we asked him if we could help him unload, and of course he gratefully accepted. And so we took the tarp off the load, and here we were riding to Fairbanks on a truckload of caskets. He had brought the caskets for the mortuary here was brought in by way of Whitehorse.
Oh, my goodness. They were empty.
Yes, they were empty. They weren't loaded. Empty caskets. It's something that a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of our freight came in through Canada, through Whitehorse, Skagway, and downriver to Central, or Circle, and then came in by over the road.
When you first came to Fairbanks on the train as a young man to be a student at the university, you said last week that there were several other students coming up for the first time on that train trip, and you said you made some lifelong friends then. Who were some of those people?
Well, of course, the one that comes to mind first is Bill Cashin, who was a young man who had been born and raised in Douglas, and, of course, his very close friend, Harry Lundell, who still resides here in Fairbanks. And there were students from practically every town on the Alaska coast, starting with Ketchikan. And there was a young man there from Ketchikan named Earl Fossey, who became my roommate later on. And there were several from Juneau, George Karabelnikov, and Ole Kukala, and then there were a number. In that particular year, there were about seven of us came from Cordova to the university. And but over the years, of course, I probably developed a closer relationship with Bill Cashin than I did with any of the others, because Bill was a crazy Irishman with a wonderful sense of humor, and he could tell stories from all day long and keep you in stitches. But he also was a very bright young man, which was illustrated by the fact that when we all came to university, as I told you, Gail, most of us came to work as well as go to school. And my job, of course, I was assigned to the kitchen and butchering, and I know that, I can think of Harry Lundell. His job was to haul coal from the siding of the railroad and load it in a truck and haul it up to the power plant and unload it. And you can imagine doing that in 30 and 40 below weather. It wasn't the most pleasant work in the world. A large number of us were also janitors, doing the janitorial work. But Bill Cashin, as I said, he was a brilliant young man. He ended up as the driver for the president of the university.
Oh.
So here he is driving around in a beautiful Buick sedan, taking the president wherever he wanted to go. And the rest of us were really working.
He was a brilliant young man.
I always envied Bill for his ability to acquire that position.
Well, that was one of the ways, I guess, that he got to know Charles Bunnell. And, of course, I've read Farthest North College President, I believe, his book on Charles Bunnell. Most interesting.
Yes. Well, in addition to that, of course, Bill was an exceptional writer. And he edited the university newspaper for many years. And he has written, or had written, several pamphlets about the Fairbanks area. And he was really a very talented man. When he graduated, went to Anchorage as a teacher. And then during the beginning of the war, he was approached to return to Fairbanks and teach at the university. And I also was approached, and didn't think much of the idea until I ran into Bill. And he said, I think I'll go up there and teach. And he said, why don't you go along? Well, I had been offered a position building the Alaska Highway at Tok, where the temperature gets down to 50, 60, 70 below. And I thought of that and thought of a nice room, warm room at the university. So it wasn't hard to make a decision.
My. Well, I want to back up just a little bit to university days under Charles Bonnell. What was it like? I know he was very involved in the welfare and doings of all of his students. Did you live in a dorm? What was the circumstances?
Yes, at the time we came, the university really consisted of a men's dorm, a woman's dorm, the administration and the administration building, which also contained the powerhouse, the library, the gymnasium, and then there was the basement of the what is now the Eielson Building.
Mm-hmm.
Had been built, and a small section of the first floor, or pardon me, the basement of the the old gymnasium was built, and then one section of the basement of the Allison Building, and that's just about. And then there were some homes for faculty, and that's about it.
Uh-huh. I'm going to be back in just a moment. Thing today, very important reminder, listeners, that these tapes do go into the Alaskan Polar Region's Oral History Archives at the university that we're speaking of right now. Okay, well, you've described the layout.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, Dr. Bonnell was the supreme being at the university, and he really and sincerely felt that every student was there, and the conduct and the life that student led was his responsibility. And so he took a personal interest in every student was there. And many of the students, he knew the families of many of the students. I can recall many stories about Dr. Bonnell. We had the dining room for the university was in the basement of the girls' dormitory, and it was twice a week, and definitely on Sunday, Bonnell required that all students who came to the dining room, all the men, be wearing a coat and have a tie, and there was one girl assigned to sit at each table. That's about the number of girls who were there, and I think there were eight. The tables had eight place settings, and then over in the corner, and kind of on a raised platform, was where Bonnell sat and had his dinner, because he ate in the dining room also with the rest of us. And every Sunday during the wintertime, Dr. Bonnell would more or less give the same speech, which he'd get up in after the dinner was underway and announce to us that the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines could in no way heat all of Alaska. And he would caution us that we were to keep our windows in our dormitories closed in order to keep the heat bill down. And then to reinforce that, in the evenings after dinner, why, Dr. Bonnell would frequently patrol the campus to see that there were no windows open, or there were, and that all the lights that were not needed were turned off. It amazes me now, many times I've remarked about from University Avenue heading up towards the university, and the whole country is lit up. And during Dr. Bunnell's time, you saw no excess lights because of the cost of operating the plant. And to continue with his interest in students, why, I recall one incident with Dr. Bunnell. I wanted to go to Anchorage to the Fur Rendezvous, and I didn't get to see him during the day, so I went down to his home in the evening and called on him, asking his permission if I had could find someone to do my work, if I could go. And so, after considerable discussion, he told me, he gave me permission to go to Anchorage. And as I was leaving his house, he said, "Just a minute, Woodrow." He says, "I have a problem which I'd like to discuss with you." And he started out by saying, "Now, if you were the president of this university, and you went to the garage where the bus driver left all of the parcels brought from town, and there on the bench in the garage, you noticed a package which contained a quart of whiskey. Now," he says, "what would you do with that?" He says, "after all," he said, "you're responsible for the students that are here, and so," he says, "what would you do?" And I told him, I said, "Dr. Mill, I have no idea what I'd do until I was in that position." And, well, he says, I was confronted with that problem. And he said, "I went and opened up the package, and there it was, a quart of whiskey, and it was addressed to a student. So," he said, "I thought in order to protect the other students and make sure that someone who did not order that liquor did not get it." So he says, I took the package over to the girls' dormitory and called the dorm hostess and asked her to call a certain girl down to her office. And he said that the girl came down, and he said, "I explained to her that I was just doing this to make sure that it was she that got the liquor and no other student." And so he says, I gave her the quart of liquor, and he said, "I left." And but that was Dr. Bunnell.
Gee whiz. During this time, the woman you later married was attending the school there. That's
yeah.
Where you met. What was that circumstance? How did you happen to meet Carolyn?
Well, I don't know. The first time that we met and actually talked, why, I was at that time a janitor in the main building, which was the building I mentioned, where the offices were, and these offices and the instruction rooms were. And this rather good-looking girl came walking down the street, or down the hallway, and so we talked for a while, and from then on I thought, well, she's really not too bad. And so we started dating, and we continued dating all the time that she was in school, and the year that she graduated, we were married, and she came. She was working in Anchorage for the railroad, and she came to Fairbanks, and of course that's the year I started teaching at the university, and we were married, and we have been here ever since, except for the 2 years when I worked for the Alaska Road Commission in Valdez.
What year did you marry?
42.
And what's her maiden name, and where is she from?
She's from, Carolyn was born and raised in Enana. And her father had been a locomotive engineer on the railroad. and had quit that and had started a trading post in Nenana.
Now, who's that?
And his name was Carl Hagstrom.
Uh-huh.
And they maintained that store until the late 1960s.
Huh. Now, she had some, earned some titles along the way. Was that...
Oh, yes.
While she was a student?
Yes, when she was a student, of course, that's the time... she was a student in Nenana High School. At the time that we started the Ice Carnival here in Fairbanks. And she came to Fairbanks as during the carnival as Miss Nenana. And then later on when she was at the university, she was Miss University. And, of course, I was kind of proud of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But... I still think that she's a very attractive woman.
She is. I've had the pleasure of meeting her, too. We'll be back in just a moment with Meet a Pioneer. We'll acknowledge our sponsors, Larson's Jewelers, Interior Signs, and the Forget-Me-Not. Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
He is waiting for you.
We're back with Meet a Pioneer and Woodrow Johansson. Well, there's so much to tell, and we've got about 12 minutes left together this morning. I just mentioned to you that you've done so many things, and Woody says, yeah, I didn't tell you the story about being a crab fisherman. I guess we can't tell all of it. But, of course, you spent 27 years, it was called different things at different times with the Alaska Road Commission. I think we need to talk about that a bit. You've got some interesting stories about building roads in Alaska.
Well, Gail, I went to work for the Alaska Road Commission in first time in 1951, and it was a federal agency, unique in the federal government in that there was no other agency that performed the tasks that it did. And... in 1956, the federal government decided that the Bureau of Public Roads could handle the work, and rather than having an orphan commission, they abandoned it or abolished it. And so the Bureau of Public Roads took over, but the work was the same, really. It was the work of a state highway department, is what it amounted to. And Of course, with the coming of statehood in 58, why, the state was in no position at that time to run a highway department. And so they contracted with the Bureau of Public Roads to continue. And they did continue until 1960, at which time the Department of Highways was created and we took over the operation. But again, it was the same work with the same people. Oh, a few changes, but not too many. Some of the federal employees chose to stay with the federal government, but the majority of them transferred to state employment. And then, of course, in about 75, the Department of Highways was reorganized to become the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, which exists today. The thing that I often think about is that when I first went to work for the Alaska Road Commission, there had been no contract work performed for them in the interior of Alaska. All work that was done by the crews of the Alaska Road Commission or the Bureau of Public Roads. And the first contract bridge that was built in the interior is the bridge over Noyes Slough on Illinois Street.
Oh, my.
And that was built in 1951. And then the following year, the bridge over Noyes Slough on Minnie Street was built. And prior to that time, in order to get from the Grail area over to Slaterville, there was a swinging bridge, a suspension bridge. And you walked across there, and it swayed quite a bit. So you had to really learn how to cross a swinging bridge over Noyes Slough.
Gee.
But when we built the bridge, of course, the swinging bridge was taken down. I kind of wish it was still up because it was quite a bridge.
What was it made out of, the swinging bridge?
It was a regular suspension bridge. Only it was made for only for pedestrians.
Oh, and it just swayed. I mean, you had kind of had to hold on. And, oh, interesting.
And the first paving job that was done on the highways in Fairbanks area is the College Road. And it was interesting when I went to work for the Road Commission. There hadn't been any procedures set up for contract administration. And so every time a problem came up, it was a big emergency. And I can recall one time I made out, this was the first year I worked for them, I made out an estimate for payment to the contractor, and I was, of course, it was a question of how do you make it out? How do they want it? And so I talked with the contract section in Juneau, and they told me what they wanted. And so I sent the estimate on down, and about the end of the week, the estimate came back, all marked up in red. And so I changed it according to the markings in red and sent it on back down. And I got a phone call, a rather irate phone call from the contract section. I wanted to know what in the world I was doing. And so I explained to them what I was doing. And it turned out that the first estimate I sent down had been approved by the contract section. But when it went to finance didn't like it, the finance section, so they wouldn't pay it. They marked it all up and sent it back to me. So that is just one of the problems we were running into when we started contracting work. And of course the procedures have been developed, and nowadays you don't run into any of those problems anymore. But I'd like to mention something, one of the projects which is close to my heart and one which I found very exciting. At the time of discovery of oil in Prudhoe Bay, there were a number of contractors who wanted to get equipment and trailer houses and stuff up north so they could continue with their work. And so there was the idea that we'll build a winter road. And of course, when the ideas was first mentioned, this was probably in the first part of October, the idea was we were going to contract the work out and handle it with some, maybe one or a group of contractors. We ran into, however, so many problems in working up the contracts that finally I was told about the 23rd of November that the highway department was going to build the ice road or the winter road from Livengood to the Yukon. And that would give us enough time, that would give the department enough time to come up with a contract from there north.
What year was this?
This was in 68.
Okay.
And so, of course, we had no equipment that was for that type of an operation. And so we had to assemble a bunch of go devils and put living quarters on them, which were nothing but trailers, really. And we had to build a mobile generating plant, and then we had to assemble a bunch of go devils for carry our oil and some fuels and whatnot. And of course, we had to have a cookhouse and a mess hall and a bunkhouse. So we finally got that stuff assembled, and we started building this winter road from Livengood up Mike Hess Creek, then down Mike Hess to the Yukon. And at the same time, we sent a couple of men to the Yukon River, where we had decided we were going to cross it to begin building an ice bridge. And of course, these men went to Stevens Village and hired as many of the natives living there as wanted to work to build this ice bridge across the Yukon, hoping that by the time we got to the Yukon, the bridge would be ready to use. Well, and the contractor would be let, and the contractor would take over.
An ice bridge? Are you talking about an arc of ice? An arch of ice?
No, an ice bridge is nothing more than a strengthening of the ice, a thickening of the ice, so that it will carry a heavier load.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so
okay.
In order to build a thing, we would just build snow berms across the ice, and two berms parallel to one another, and a distance apart as how wide you want the road. And we usually put it about 50 feet.
Okay.
And then we would put dig holes through the Yukon River ice, and then just pump water onto the ice and sort of thicken it.
Oh, my gosh, okay.
And, of course, in addition, we put three rows of spruce timber, spruce trees, one across the river, so that it would kind of tie the ice together in case it started to crack and stuff. And, of course, I was informed later by some ice specialists that wasn't necessary, but I felt a lot better because it was done. Well, anyway, we got the ice bridge built, and we finally got to the Yukon River with this operation about a week before Christmas, and we thought we were done. And as far as doing anything by ourselves, well, so we sat we asked them if we should disband, and they said, no, let's hang on for a while. And so the outfit sat there on the south bank of the Yukon River. And, of course, this was in December, and the temperature was getting kind of cold. And then about the first of the year, we were told, you're going to have to build it to Sag 1. Build a road to Sag 1 with your own forces. Well, of course, we didn't have the equipment or anything to do it with our own forces, so we rented equipment, and we, with the idea we'd start north. Well, of course, at this time, the temperature at the river where our camp was from 60 to 70 below zero, and we couldn't move. If we picked up a wire and an electrical wire to move it, why, the insulation would fall off, and of course kerosene froze, and the diesel oil was so thick it wouldn't run, and it was rather miserable. And then every day pretty near I'd get a call from the commissioner in Juneau wanting to know why we're not moving. And finally, I got a call from him saying that if you're not moving by next Monday, we're going to shut it down. Well, it would just happen that about the time I got the call from him, the weather broke, and we started across the river and started north. And then on the Monday, we got a call from him saying that the governor wants you to shut it down. Well, of course, I had no radio communication with my crew, so I couldn't shut it down, so we kept on going. And we got to Bettles and then up the John River and down the Anaktuvik to Sag 1.
Oh, my word.
But it was really an experience.
Sounds like a monumental feat and under difficult conditions.
Well, without the crews that we had, we would never have made it. The bunkhouses, for instance, the beds never got cold. Because the night shift would be working and the day shift would be sleeping. And then when the shift changed, they'd just be different people in the beds.
Oh, my. That's a wonderful story, a story of a lot of hard work. Going to acknowledge just a couple more of our sponsors. Now, you'll help me do one of these in just a moment, Woody. Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the Riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
Well, our other sponsor is our very newest sponsor, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, and it's kind of an interesting story about it. I think on our premier day of it being a sponsor, I'll just mention a couple of things. Mount McKinley has a very fascinating story about the start of that bank, and it was so interesting when I was over the other day, earlier this week, going through scrapbooks and talking to Ingeborg Wilson, that who was one of the original members of the Board of Trustees, that I just decided I think we would need to have, this is a story that will be fitting for me to pioneer. So we're going to hear more about their story in a couple of weeks, I believe the 18th of January. But they started in December of 1965, so this is their 20th year serving Fairbanks. And so it's kind of an interesting story as I'm told Woody when I went to do a pre-interview for our time together last week and this week. I had contacted Jerry Schlittler at the bank, and because of their interest in the community and the pioneers and the things that they've published and their involvement, and I thought that it might be fitting sponsors, and so I contacted Jerry, and he says, well, who have you got on this week? I said, Woody Johansson. He says, well, I'll listen to him and decide. And so, did you feel a little bit of pressure when I told you that, Woody?
No, I thought about it, but I didn't.
Not too much. Well, it was fun because just moments after, he did call and decided to sponsor the program, which we were glad, but I feel that I must credit some of that to you, certainly. It was a fine interview, and it was very nice to have you back.
Well, I enjoyed it, really, Gail.
Thank you for sharing your stories with us. It's very fascinating. You and Carolyn, of course, live in town, and your four children are all in this area.
That's correct, yes. All of them live here. We're very fortunate.
I'd like once again to thank our sponsors of Meet a Pioneer, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Sophie Station, Interior Signs, the Two Rivers Lodge, Forget Me Not, Carol Davis of the Denali Chiropractic Clinic, the Binkley family of the Riverboat Discovery, and the Larson family of Larson's Jewelers.
Gail, I have enjoyed these 2-hour sessions we've had, and I just hope and I know that you will get some more of the pioneers here to add to the history of interior Alaska.